Welcome, everybody. This is Dee, and I'm the special event coordinator here at Smart Recovery. We are very, very excited about today's special event, Maintaining Change, Supporting Self-Regulation and Recovery with Dr. Carlo DiClemente. So with that, without any further ado at all, I'm going to turn you over to my friend and colleague, Hugh Delaney, truly exceptional volunteer, facilitator, and promoter of Smart Recovery. Hugh?
Thank you, Dee. And welcome again, everyone, to today's presentation sponsored by Smart Recovery. My name, again, is Hugh Delaney, and I'm a Smart Recovery meeting facilitator and assist the Capital Region with marketing efforts. When I introduce the Smart program to people, my first comment is that Smart is a science-based program offering practical tools that help develop self-empowering skills in a group support setting. Well, most of that is pretty easy to explain, and yet the hardest part is trying to explain the science-based piece. I remember facilitating my first meeting when an adamant man remarked that he did not need science to help him stop drinking. Well, today, I facilitated more than 400 meetings, and it's much easier for me to explain the science basis to the SMART program. In practice, the tools and methods of SMART are drawn from many psychological understandings of addiction and therapies to change behavior. Chief among these are motivational enhancement therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, rational emotive behavioral therapy, and the trans-theoretical model of behavioral change. So today's presentation, Dr. Carlo C. DiClemente will discuss the challenges of maintaining change set in a larger discussion of how self-regulation and self-control impact both short and long-term recovery. He will also explore how support systems can provide the scaffolding needed for the individual to successfully sustain recovery of health and well-being. For the past 25 years, Dr. DiClemente has conducted funded research in health and addictive behaviors. He co-developed a trans-theoretical model of behavioral change, as well as offered numerous scientific articles and books on motivation and behavioral change. In fact, his 29-page CV is filled with citations of his research, publications, and professional accomplishments. Far too many for me to recite today. Currently, Dr. DiClemente is professor and chairs the Department of Psychology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He also directs the UMBC Center for Community Collaboration and the MD Quit Tobacco Resource Center. Finally, Dr. DiClemente serves on the Smart Recovery International Advisory Council. So please join me in welcoming Dr. DiClemente. Carlo?
Well, thank you. I appreciate the intro, kind intro, and glad to be here with all of you who are on the call. I just was distracted because I saw a little thing that said applause. So somebody obviously gave applause. So thank you. I appreciate that as well. So let me talk today about this idea about maintaining change and some of the thoughts that I've been having about how what we need to do and some of the mechanisms that are really important in this idea about maintaining change. So what I'm going to do is look at the tasks of change that are part of the stage idea and then focus on the personal process of change, where we think about both change-specific mechanisms called processes of change and change-regulating mechanisms, which are the self-regulating, self-control mechanisms that we'll talk about as we go through. And then,
excuse me for a minute here.
Sure.
Do you have some slides you can show us?
Oh, I have to. I see. Show my screen. That's what I was doing. Okay. So she just handed it over to me, and now I think you can see my slides. So
yes,
can you see them now?
Can. Yep.
Okay, so we start there. There we go. That's the first one.
Great.
The so I wanted to kind of also be careful that to kind of help you understand that there are multiple kind of influences on change, and some of them we can think about as mechanisms, which are really kind of primary causative factors. So if you think about a car, it's the engine, the gas, these are the mechanisms that make it go. There's moderators. So these are things that influence a change and can either help or hinder a change that takes place. But they're really only secondarily causative. Flat tires and road construction and other kind of stuff moderate how fast you can go, whether you can go, and all of those kind of things. But they don't really make you go. They're not the mechanisms. And thirdly, what I've been kind of musing about in the last few years is there also seem to be markers of change. And it's often difficult to find out what's a mechanism and what's a marker, because markers are really just indicators that the mechanisms or the moderators are happening. So if you think about a speedometer, it does nothing. It's not a mechanism, it's not a moderator. It may be a moderator for you when you're driving and you see that you're doing 70 or 80 miles an hour, but it's really just a marker of the functioning of the car and how fast it's going. So those are important distinctions. I'm not going to focus a lot on them, but I think it's really important that you understand that there are different kinds of ways to influence change and different influences that we think about when we're working on this process. Now, where have typically we've looked at mechanisms of change? Well, you know, the interestingly, we've done a lot of research, but a lot of the research has been in areas where I don't think these are the primary mechanisms of change. So the first thing that a lot of therapists have done in terms of them is we've studied ourselves. So we've studied the interventions and the treatments, our alliance, the dose, and all of those do influence change, but it's not clear that those are the primary mechanisms of change. We've also studied the provider characteristics. So who is it? Is it the empathy skill? And we know those make a difference, but are those really the mechanisms, or are those moderators, or are those, you know, markers of change? And I think that's another thing that we have to think about. In Project Match, we did the attribute by treatment. So certain types of people with certain types of treatment will really do better. And there's some evidence for that, but it's not really compelling. Some people have given up on the individual and kind of focused on the environment. So people kind of think, okay, well, we can get change going. We'll just make policy, or we'll change the physical environment. And again, all of those influence change, but it's not clear how many of them are mechanisms and how many of them are moderators of change. So enforcement often is, I think, a moderator of change, not a so some of the laws around drunk driving and that kind of stuff, they may moderate the change process for one individual person, but I don't think they're a main mechanism that does it. So we get down to the bottom, it's really the person. And we've done a lot of work on personality and demographics, but we've not done as much work on motivation and the process of change. And as of course you know, there's a lot of genetics and neuroscience, but even there, it's not clear whether a genetic influence is a mechanism, a moderator, or just a marker. So we have to, again, I think about and think through for all of these. So I just wanted you to have the bigger picture, but we're really going to focus on the process stuff. So there's a lot of evidence that says that the personal process of change is really a key mechanism for recovery. This personal process is directly related to their engagement. It's really involved in all the changes that occur. Because if you really want a mechanism, and people can change on their own, so we have the whole self-change, you have the mutual help influences, and we have placebo. All of those have helped create changes. And so we have changes that happen without therapy. And so we need, if you're going to understand the change process, you have to be broader than just the intervention. And so there's a lot of different variables that are interactive and connected, but it seems to me that if you look at the change process, you get the core of the change, and then you can see how other things influence that process itself. So I'm going to just run through just quickly a couple of slides of evidence that these personal process dimensions are really important for us to understand change and maintenance of change. So, you know, we have intention and motivation. Well, you know, we have goals, commitment, motivation, predict not only short-term, but also long-term outcomes, and predict not only in psychosocial, but also in pharmacotherapy. So motivation seems to be an important dimension that goes across time and types of treatment. We also know that there is what we call natural, unaided, or self-change. I mean, when I first got into this field, they used to call it spontaneous recovery. But there's really nothing spontaneous about it. It takes a lot of work to do the recovery. It's just that they don't use treatment. So it's really self-guided change. And of course, the Sobels have done a lot of work in that area. But when you look at what they talk about with self-guided change, it includes mechanisms like decision-making and commitment and self-reevaluation and behavioral coping, all of which are critical pieces of the change process. And then finally, we have the placebo responding. I mean, people respond to inert ingredients with significant changes. So we have to kind of think about that. What does that mean? Well, it means that the change mechanisms are probably in the person. And placebos are really effective. I mean, you know, actually, placebos change endogenous opioids, change the brain. And there was an interesting study that Benedetti did that medical treatments delivered surreptitiously. So if you don't know you're getting the treatment, it's not effective. So, and even the SSRIs, much of the effect of the SSRIs are considered due to placebo. So expectations. So what does that mean? Well, it means that expectations, personal expectations, are really important in the process and in recovery and in maintenance of recovery. So we need to pay attention to those. We also know that what people do during treatment and in, if you're doing aftercare or smart recovery groups, what they're doing in those groups is important. So we have commitment language and, you know, some of the MI variables. If the patient talks more than the therapist, actually, that's a good sign. And then we have something that's gone back a long ways in terms of setting a date. So getting somebody to make an intention and set a date for I'm going to make the change on Tuesday morning it increases the intention. So that's an implementation intention, as they talk about in the theory of planned behavior. But that really helps make change happen. And we also have some important variables that I've been really working on and trying to understand, and we're publishing on temptation and craving. Seem to be important things that are self-evaluations of vulnerability and strength to be able to make change happen. Self-efficacy is a very robust predictor of change and long-term change. And this new variable that we've kind of been working on, this temptation minus confidence. So how tempted are you in all these situations and how confident are you in these situations? And if I look at the difference, that often will also predict long-term change. And I'll show you some data about that in a minute or two. But we just finished, a grad student of mine just published her thesis on that area, looking at kind of the difference and how it predicted time to first drink, how many drinks during that a person had during the first week that they drank. So those self-evaluations, which again are really patient process perspective, from a patient process perspective, are really kind of important as we go through this. Also, we know that if change is hard, but we have brief interventions that actually help make change. So again, a brief intervention, I think at that point you kind of say, well, you know, this can't be possible for people not drinking as much. We did a study in the shock trauma unit they dramatically changed drinking levels in terms of binge episodes over 12 months after that intervention. And it was a 15-minute intervention. So we'd like to be credit for the magic. But that really, I mean, it can't be just that. It's got to be that we triggered something inside the individual that helped make this change in awareness and move that person forward in the process. And we also know there are developmental things that happen. You know, people get pregnant, people get married, and it makes changes in addictive behaviors. So we know that it's got to be the person. And I'm going to show you some data from Project Match and from another project that we did to try and look at the change process variables and how they relate to outcomes. And I'll do that in a minute. I wanted to kind of talk a little bit about the model first and then go there. So, Dee, are there any questions that people have that they've sent to you that at this point I can answer before moving into the next section?
Well, it appears that everybody is mesmerized as I am, but let's see. Let's give people a chance for 1 second. Anybody? Or shall we plunge forward? Let's go ahead. And if people go ahead and type as we go, and then we'll take another little pause like this and pick up questions that have come up.
Perfect. Okay. So, again, the people think of this model as the stages of change model, but that's only one part of it. The stages really are the tasks. Identify tasks that are important in the process of change. The processes of change are really the change engines. If we're looking at mechanisms, I bet more on processes of change as the mechanisms. And I'll talk a little more about that in a minute. The other piece is that you need to realize that the context of change, so lots of other things happening in a person's life, impact their use of processes and their ability to move through the stages. So there are lots of different pieces of this puzzle. So it's a complex process, and that's why it's been so hard for us to get our hands around it. And then finally, I think of markers of change. I don't think decisional balance, decision is a process or decision making, but the decisional balance is really a marker of change. It says where is someone with regard to their pros and cons, and also self-efficacy and temptation. People like to see self-efficacy as a mechanism, but I wonder sometimes if self-efficacy is really a marker, that it really kind of marks how far along in the process of change this person is in terms of the solidifying of the maintenance of change. So as I go through maintenance, I get more confident and I get less tempted. And I'll show you that in a minute as well. So if I want to get into and stay in recovery, it requires completion of the stage tasks in a manner that's sufficient to support long-term recovery. And I'll talk a little more about that in a minute. Using the processes of change can help promote and deepen completion of these tasks. So building confidence, avoiding overconfidence, and being realistic about risks is also a key part of this recovery process. So this is what I think about. If we think about tasks, if I have somebody in pre-contemplation, I really need to engage interest and concern. If I have them in contemplation, there's the most important task that they need to deal with is risk-reward analysis, decision-making. If I have them in preparation, it's commitment, planning, prioritizing. All of those kind of things are really important to move forward so that I can implement the plan well and then revise the plan when it doesn't work. And then finally, when I'm moving into maintenance and maintaining change, I need to integrate this into my lifestyle and also avoid kind of going back. But each of these tasks, I mean, a lot of times we think about relapse as this. And I think, you know, Alan Marlott and Gordon and the folks that have worked on that have talked about maintenance, you know, and relapse as kind of the area where you're working on. But basically, relapse isn't just a problem of problematic maintenance. It could be a problem of any of these if they're not done well enough. So if these processes are not completed well enough to support action and support this integrated lifestyle and avoiding relapse, then we have relapse. But relapse is, the process of relapse is going back and getting these done right. So the arrow, size of the arrow, indicates that these can be done more or less well. And so it's really moving through this process with the maximum depth of kind of a decision. So I, you know, people make a decision and then they make a really hard, a big decision, and then they make a decision that they're really committed to. It's the decision that you're really committed to that's going to have the best chance of helping you move into the plan and getting into maintenance and sustaining that change. So that's really the idea behind the tasks. And I'll jump to next. So when you're thinking about what am I doing in terms of my work with a particular client, you're working to promote accomplishment of each of these tasks. So you need to be thinking about how each of these things are going and how, what do I do to get them? So if I think about doing different things at different points in the process, I need to be doing, what are my skills and what are my strategies for engaging interest and concern? How do I best promote decision making? How do I kind of focus on planning? What's the best ways to get commitment? What's the best ways to kind of build a plan that's viable? And I say plans have got to be effective, acceptable, and accessible. If you don't have all three of those pieces, you don't have a good plan. So we need to kind of figure out how to make each of these tasks done well enough that's going to support that final piece of integrating into the lifestyle. And then also managing any slips and relapses that occur, I think, is also part of the process that we need to happen. So I try to make a distinction. If I'm thinking about mechanisms of change, I think about those as in the client. So then you go, well, what am I doing then? So what's the provider task, what's the client's work, and what's the difference? And as I see it, the client is in charge of the processes of change and completing the tasks and doing the activities that are important to make change happen. The provider offers strategies and services to support that process and those activities. So that's how I see that working. And the processes, let me quickly run through these. As you, those of you who know the model, you think about experiential processes. These are more about thought processes and feelings and those kind of things, and they're generally seen in earlier stages, and behavioral processes that are more action-oriented. And if we look at these in detail, I'm not going to have a chance to go through these in too much detail, but these processes are the engines, the change engines, and they come from the different theories of therapy. So that's why this was called trans-theoretical from the beginning. Basically, we identified processes or principles of change that come out of different theories. And if you read some of our work, you'll see where some of these come. But they're the engines. So for example, you know, if I teach a course, my job for the students in that class is to engage their consciousness racing. And that's what I need to do. If I'm trying to do to work with a client, my job is sometimes to engage their self-reevaluation and their environmental reevaluation. And sometimes I do the same things with two clients and I don't engage those processes. That doesn't necessarily mean I'm doing something wrong. It means that the client isn't reacting to what the strategies I'm using to engage those processes. So that's really what I see as the interaction between what we do and what they do, because you need these processes to get decision-making going, to get interest and concern, to get planning and commitment and all those kinds of things. These are more important in those first three tasks, and then you move to the behavioral processes, which are much more important in the planning and the preparation and the action and the maintenance piece. So if you think about it, you got the pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation. You need much more of the experiential processes moving you there, and then you need to switch into behavioral processes. And that's why what's nice about cognitive behavioral therapy is it really says, oh, you got to pay attention to what people are thinking and feeling as well as what people are doing to get the change really happening. And these are really very behavioral processes that most of you know and use in either Smart Recovery or your own treatment programs. So the idea then is, here's what we're trying to do, is increase these processes to get those tasks done in order to make change happen. And that's really the trans-theoretical model, is really about the interaction of the stages and the processes. Now, I want to show you a little bit of data so that we can kind of move forward and leave enough time to have some questions as well. So with Project Match, we looked at and discovered some what we call success profiles. So if you remember, in Project Match, we had 12-step, we had cognitive behavioral, and we had motivational enhancement treatments. And all three treatments ended up producing very similar drinking outcomes. There is a little more total abstinence in TSF, but basically all three treatments produced similar amounts of drinking in the post-treatment 1 year follow-up, and then even at 3 years. So there's no difference across many of these variables by stage, by treatment. However, if you look at these differences, these dimensions, and then look at drinking outcomes, there's a big difference. And so, you know, you don't need statistics for this. There's no difference between these three treatments in terms of their total process activity at the end of treatment. So that's pretty clear. They're pretty much the same. However, if you look at, we clustered people by their activity. So if you look at this, you can kind of see the red line is high sustained process activity over the treatment time. So you see there's session one, session two, session six, and post-treatment for all three treatment conditions. If you have if you're in the cluster that has high sustained process activity, or you have low, the yellow, and I'll show you what the outcomes are for that. And then there was one group that was going up and one group that was coming down. And here's what happens. The high sustained process activity is always better in terms of AA attendance, percent days absent, percent days during follow-up, and the low sustained process activity is, and the declining, is always worse, or worse in terms of drinks per drinking day and drinks per drinking day during year one follow-up. So sustained process activity seems to be important for individuals to make changes and to keep those changes going. Efficacy also changes over time. This is baseline versus 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months. Again, this is for the whole group, so this is successes and failures together. But you see, as a group, everybody in all three treatments builds efficacy. And there's no significant difference for treatment assignment, but there is for time. So you see that there's a time effect. Now, if you look here, this analysis looked at people who had low readiness and low self-efficacy, and people who had high readiness and high self-efficacy, and two groups in the middle. Again, what do you see? This is their baseline measures. This is when they came into treatment. The people with the high readiness and high self-efficacy did best throughout the year. The people with the low readiness and low self-efficacy had the worst percent days abstinent in the group. So again, if you just look at that and you break people out, and you can see also that high readiness and low self-efficacy seems to be doing a little bit better than low readiness and high self-efficacy over time. So you can see that these variables matter. The same thing here with drinks, it's just the opposite. But basically, it's the same outcomes. So it's percent days abstinent and how many drinks they drink on a drinking day are driven by, when people come in, their readiness and their self-efficacy. It's also true that what we see is that change process activity then seems to be, during treatment, at the end of treatment, influences early and later outcomes. And also self-efficacy seems to track drinking behavior over time. And that these variables also influence attendance at Mutual Help, which is an interesting piece. So these are the variables that also impact attendance at AA and Smart Recovery and other kinds of processes like that. So we did one other thing to do this analysis. We actually kind of split up people in these three, in this large trial, in the outpatient. We split up people by what they did in the 1 year post-treatment. So we had the abstinent people, the moderate drinking people, and the heavier drinking people. So then we looked at, what did these people look like on process variables at the beginning of treatment and at the end of treatment. And so here's what we show. So what you see is the abstinent group in yellow is different when they walk in the door. So this is a group that stayed abstinent from the end of treatment through the 12 months of post-treatment. And the red group is the group that did the heaviest drinking in the post-treatment period, the 1 year post-treatment. And the middle group is the group that did more moderate drinking. They didn't really get into heavy binge drinking, but they were drinking. They were not abstinent. And you see they sometimes, as they walk in the door, look a little bit like more like the abstinent group. Well, what distinguishes these groups at the end of treatment? What would be a success profile? Well, this is what it would look like. High in action scores, which is really taking responsibility, doing something, all of those kind of variables. Low in is struggling to maintain, it's not maintenance. So they have less maintenance struggle, they have high confidence, they have low temptation, and they're using processes, especially behavioral processes, more than the other group. What's interesting is the heavier drinkers are exactly the opposite on those key variables. There are significant differences. And the middle group, the moderate drinking group, is sometimes looks a little more like the abstinent group and sometimes looks a little more like the heavier drinking group. So they're kind of in the middle on many of these variables, though they are using process activity in order to kind of keep that drinking moderate, because most of the people who came into our treatments had met alcohol dependence criteria. So what you see is that the processes, the process activity of the individual seems to distinguish outcomes when treatments don't. So we need to focus on what's the client doing and where are they in this process. We did the same. This is a small trial that we did with drug abusers and found exactly the same profile, that these are people who the blue group is the people who are abstinent at 6 months, and the red group are people who were still using either heroin, cocaine, or marijuana. And what you see is this is at 3 months into treatment or post-intake. We looked at their variables, and you see they have high experiential behavioral processes, high self-efficacy, and low temptation. And the people that are using have exactly the opposite profile. So these process variables seem to be very, very important. And as you also see, it's the difference between the efficacy and the temptation. As temptation is going down and efficacy is getting higher, that's really there. What you see here is efficacy is low and temptation is high, which is a predictor of continued use or relapse as you go through. So again, the idea is we have a way of thinking about the process and how can we move people through this process by engaging in their processes of change and promoting their process of change. And you realize that when there are competing demands, if there are contextual problems where other people around them are doing a lot of drinking and they're trying to stay sober, if there are poor self-regulation skills, it impacts this process of change. And it impacts the completion of the tasks. And so that's why I think regulation is important, and we're going to take a couple of minutes to do that as well. So what I've just talked about are really what I call behavior-specific change processes. They're really focused on, okay, you're changing your drinking. These are the processes that you're going to look at. And they're usually behavior-specific. So if I want to do change processes for alcohol, it may be helpful for my marijuana use, but it may have nothing to do with my marijuana use unless I'm using change processes that are focused also on marijuana. But these self-evaluations require basic self-regulation and self-control. So self-regulation is really that ability that we have to manage internal and external demands on us in a way that's responsive to feedback and available information, flexible in seeking solutions, and doesn't overtax the system. So it's really an ability to kind of roll with what's coming and be able to moderate or manage stresses and handle challenges and be able to kind of still function and manage our life. So many of you probably know that all of our treatments ask people to do stuff that requires self-regulation. So we ask people to do some self-observation, do some decision-making, do some planning. All of those include or affect executive cognitive functioning and affect regulation. So they're essential mechanisms for both initiation and modification. So what I think of as self-regulation is really a change-regulating dimension. Many of you already know Baumeister has done some really interesting stuff on self-control strength, kind of identifying self-control as a muscle that can become fatigued and replenished. And that, I think, has resonated with me a great deal, because I do think that we haven't focused enough on the self-control strength of the individual. We tend to treat everybody as though, oh, you can do this now. But if they're really exhausted, if their self-control muscle is depleted and fatigued, it's going to be very difficult to get them to do all the engage in the processes that are important in making the change happen. So I've been thinking more about self-control, and these are some of the dimensions. You know, it's not limitless. It's got to be conserved. That's why focus is important. And you need a bunch of this to be able to make changes in addictive behaviors. So if you're tapped out and need it to make changes, you're not going to be able to be successful. So again, it's really important in managing or stopping addictive behaviors or excessive behaviors. And you need it. So what do we, and it fits with our new understanding or our growing understanding of the neurocircuits and the neurochemical stuff that's happening with addiction. This is Kube's model that talks about how self-regulation or executive functioning, incentive salience, and negative emotion. So affect regulation, self-regulation, how they all kind of contribute to this cycle that focuses, that really gets there. You have the intoxication, you have the withdrawal, you have all the preoccupation that they need. And then you move back into that, and it creates what George is kind of talking about as kind of this is a relapsing disorder, because this thing goes, and as soon as stress hits this system, it really has no ability to kind of react in a way that's functional. It goes back to this dysfunctional kind of process. So we're not going to go much into that. So I've been thinking about, well, what do you do if somebody has poor self-control strength? And there's a concept in developmental psychology they call scaffolding. It's things that people do when kids are small. So basically, parents do a lot of scaffolding. I mean, from holding their little fingers, when you put your fingers out, hold on to this as they try to walk, you're scaffolding. You're trying to help them perform tasks that they're not quite ready to do by giving them support and building a scaffold around it so they can be somewhat successful, but they also can be protected. So just as a scaffold in a building, you use a scaffold to build and protect the process while you're building it and keep things holding up, right? So how can we, what can we do about impaired self-regulation? Well, recognize that this self-regulation, both affect and executive cognitive function, can disrupt the client's work and the process of change. And think about creatively, how can we provide the scaffolding? I mean, in some ways, smart recovery is a scaffolding program, because you're building an external support system that people can come to actually help them and support this process of change. While they're same with AA, same with a lot of programs, but also more extensive programs provide scaffolding. I mean, I've been looking into some of the modified therapeutic communities. A lot of what they do is provide scaffolding while the self-regulation process is getting repaired and the ability is getting built to be able to do things. And the issue is, again, making sure the building is well built before you take down the scaffolding. That's a critical piece. So here's a little summary thing. So how do treatment and mutual help fit in? So even before people commit to treatment, they're engaged in client processes of change. They wouldn't come in unless they had some kind of pressure or process that was going that said, okay, I better go see if I can do something with this. And if they're motivated, they really want your help. So treatment is really a mediator or a moderator of change, not a direct producer. It's really the client processes and how treatment may be able to mediate or help that process move forward, and how client then continues that process, how the support systems, family, mutual help, and treatment continue to help support that process until you get a good outcome. And that's really how I think about both self-regulation and a process of change. So interventions aren't like this. You slap a individual with an intervention to change a particular behavior. They're much more like this. You jump into a stream. Anytime you're trying to help somebody, they've been places, then they're going places, and you're trying to help direct the stream. And there's some smart, there's some things that are helpful and hindering, and there's a lot of other complicating problems over here. So that's why treatment is difficult and challenging for us and for the individual who's kind of going through this change process. So let me quickly finish by saying recovery is really a personal journey. But that journey is not just away from addiction, it's toward health and well-being. I really love the recovery-oriented systems of care that we're trying to build that focus on well-being, sexual health, physical health, all of those kind of things that we should be helping people move towards, because addiction interferes with most of those things. Support systems, both familial, formal, and informal, need to try and keep engaging with client change processes, supporting efficacy and offering alternatives that are really reinforcing to the individual, and scaffolding when self-control is compromised. So I just have a little note here about stress, substances, and self-regulation. I'm the chair of the Friends of NIAAA, which is a group of organizations that are, I represent RSA, but a group of organizations that are supporting NIAAA and its work. And we had a briefing just last week on stress, alcohol, and trauma. And it was really interesting. George Koob talked, and so did Rajita Sinha from Yale. But the guy who came in at the end to talk was a veteran who had both alcohol and opiate addiction, who had tried to kill himself, who had gone through multiple treatments, and ultimately ended up in a long-term treatment funded by a donor who gave $150,000 for this person to stay in treatment for 10 months. And was now in 3 years of recovery and helping other vets. He was just in D.C. for the Vets for Vets for Warriors. So a support group actually for veterans, and told a very moving story of his own personal movement through the process of change to be at this point in his recovery and to be helping other people. So I think, you know, the process is personal. He's still in that process of change, even though he's no longer in treatment, but he's using some of the self-help support and mutual help support that is around, both for the veteran stuff and his own trauma and PTSD, and for his recovery, going to NAA meetings. So let's not forget this process perspective for motivation, self-regulation, and change, in order to help our patients' challenges for change in self-management and coping. And I'm hoping that I know we want, and you said it, we want best practices, we want empirically supported, evidence-based treatments, but we also need to make sure that we are focused on the more basic mechanisms of self-control, motivation, and personal process of change in order to be able to create interventions and strategies that would be most effective and tailored to that particular person's need at that particular person at that particular time. So thank you. I'm going to turn it back over, or Dee is going to, we can have some questions, and then we're going to turn it back over to you for the final piece of this. Right? I think I have that.
Yes.
Right, don't I?
Yes, you have that correct.
All right.
We have a few questions, and I'm thinking a couple more may be generated as we go. But the first one was, to what extent does unconscious processing play a role in this model? That was back towards the beginning of the talk.
Right. No, I think that's a key element, and actually many of my students are actually trying to understand implicit attitudes and how they interact with explicit attitudes. So for a lot of the stuff that we've talked about in terms of the pros and cons and the measures that we have, most of those measures are really of explicit, more conscious self-evaluations. But there are less conscious self-evaluations and implicit attitudes that also impact change. So what we just found in one study was implicit attitudes do impact explicit attitudes in some way. They change them. They kind of, so the less positive the implicit attitudes are, the more the cons of change are. So there's an important interaction between implicit and explicit activities across this whole change process. And that's, again, true as you get into maintenance and stuff. We need to be, the change at the deeper level means that you're also changing, attentional bias. One of my students is working on that. And you're changing other things that are less conscious, as well as changing some of the more conscious activities. So it's really part of the process. I haven't really kind of talked about it very much here.
Okay, I have a couple that are related. One is, how can we increase readiness and self-efficacy, or help people increase their readiness and self-efficacy? And are tools like the RRA, or risk-reward analysis, or the cost-benefit analysis, CBA, appropriate for pre-contemplation?
Both good questions. So I do think that, I mean, we've meshed the self, the whole motivational process and motivational interviewing and using motivational enhancement strategies. So I think you do that by learning more. I mean, I think motivational interviewing has a lot of wonderful techniques that can support and help some of these tasks. I think that some of the decision-making literature and persuasion literature is also really important to learn from. They have a lot of ways of doing that. So Cialdini has a book called Persuasion, and I think that's another interesting way to kind of look at it. Again, it can't be manipulative, because I think that's not what we're trying to do. But learning how to be persuasive is and do that. The self-efficacy piece also is highlighted in motivational interviewing, but there are a number of ways to increase self-efficacy. So Bandura talks about the best way is behavioral enactment, getting people to actually do some things and having some successes. So success builds efficacy, efficacy builds success. So we need to kind of keep working on that, get people to do things that are small enough that they can be successful at them, and then highlight that success and have them take that as internally and move forward. In terms of the risk-reward analysis, I still think those are very valuable. And I know Bill and Jed Rose have kind of talked about some stuff about, or Rose has talked about stuff about, maybe it increases ambivalence. I think that there's two things about the risk-reward analysis that I'd like to highlight. First, it's not about just the statements about what are the pros and what are the cons. It's about values. So you need to be focusing on the values of the individual, not just their reasons or needs or desires, what they've said explicitly. Because the more that these are, the pros of change are connected to the value system of the individual, the better the decision-making process that individual can engage in. So that's one. The second is, it's really important, and I think what we're doing in a lot of our trainings now is focusing on, you know, there is change and sustained talk. I mean, there's just as much sustained talk in most of the conversations that we have as change talk. So I think what Bill and others have been concerned about is, well, you could feed into the ambivalence by kind of focusing only on the sustained talk. And that's true. What we're doing with a group, you can create a sustained talk spiral in a group that will just get everybody kind of convinced that change is impossible. So you need to break that and even with the individual and with a group, and you need to be focusing more on the change talk and really supporting that. So I think that's really one way to kind of use it effectively. But I agree that if you do a risk reward analysis and they focus more on the risks of change and the rewards of staying the same, you're really, it's going to get into a, you're going to keep people in ambivalence or move them back to pre-contemplation.
This is very interesting to us here at Smart Recovery, because we use the CBA, the cost-benefit analysis, quite a bit, we have the RRA available as well. And one of the things that our founder, Joe Gerstein, created was something he called the HOV, the Hierarchy of Values, which I think Jonathan is indicating that's the combination of the CBA with the HOV is sort of a way to address that. I have one other question, but let's answer this. Do you have an example of change talk versus sustained talk?
Well, sure. Any arguments for change. So if I'm a smoker and I say, it would really be good for my health if I could quit this thing. But I tried last time and it's so damn hard, I can't do it. So you have a change talk in the first part and sustained talk in the second part. So arguments for and against change are what MI talks about as change talk and sustained talk. So sustained talk is anything, I can't do it. It's actually, the problem is that we've talked about change talk as being darn language, right? Desires, abilities, reasons, and needs. But you could use darn language for sustained talk as well. The desire not to change, the inability to change, so all of that can become sustained talk if you're really talking about why I can't change. So that's the difference, I think, between both those two.
Thank you. I don't mean to be hurrying you along so much. I'm just fascinated by everything. I don't want to waste any time at all. What assessment tools are available that we can use in our work that would allow us to discover our client's TTM profile?
So, this may sound a little, listening is the best assessment process that you could use. If you really listen, you can hear the change processes. So when I do some trainings, I show Terry Moyer's tape of the rounder. It's a tape where she does an interview with this guy who is an alcoholic and having trouble. But I tell people, don't look at the therapist, just watch the client, and you can see emotional arousal, self-reevaluation, environmental reevaluation, consciousness raising. You can see all of those processes if you listen and are looking for those processes. So, commitment language is really self-liberation. So you see those processes going if you look at them, and you can understand the tasks if you just probe somewhat about where are you really in this process. And so I think listening and probing is really the best way in a clinical setting. In terms of some of the measurement pieces, we do have a processes of change scale that's been used and that can measure those, and we do that for research. We have the Eureka, and there's other readiness for change assessments that you could use for that. But I, again, think that these are state variables, so they move as the client moves. And you need to be listening and tracking those things. It's hard to kind of say, okay, I'm going to give you this assessment, and now when you come in next week, you're going to be in the same place that you were when I gave you the assessment last week. So that's why I think it's really important.
Thank you. Let me ask you one more quick question, I think, and then let's start to turn this over to you. Is there a point when the new behavior is considered permanent, that's not a great word, but stable, 5 years or so? Jonathan is asking this.
Yeah, so we in research, we've used sometimes 2 years or sometimes 5 years as what we call a termination point. So, and I can just give you this by example of me and my smoking. So I quit smoking a long time ago, but I'm in termination for smoking. I don't use any effort. So really what that means is it's not that that I'm never like anybody who has never smoked, because I know smoking, I could do it. My brain knows nicotine. I mean, I have lots of things that are connected to the smoking habit that I could go back in a much quicker than anybody could start. But for me, it's not going to be a relapse at this point. For me, it's going to be a reinitiation. And so I do think that's important, because I do think that relapse and reinitiation are two very different processes. I mean, relapse happens as I'm struggling to get free. Reinitiation happens once I have some stability. And I would call it stability. And I don't know. There may be some people who are, it's not 5 years. The first person I, one of the people I interviewed in my dissertation, I said, well, when did you know you really had quit smoking? And he said, 7 years after I stopped. I said, well, why? He said, I was in an automobile accident. My truck was destroyed, and I got out, and I didn't want a cigarette. So it depends on the person, I think. And then I know people who are 8 years off who say, if I found out I had a terminal illness, I'd go back to smoking as soon as I could. So I don't know that it's a time dimension. I think it's really a, again, it's a process dimension. It's knowing when that process of change is kind of quieted and I have put that behavior over here so I can work on other things. So that's a quick answer. It's probably a more complicated issue.
Thank you. Now, that's fantastic. I'm just going to hand things over to you, because we're right up to the hour. Gosh, I could listen to you for a long time, Dr. DeClemente.
Thank you.
But let me give this to Hugh. Thank you so much on behalf of SMART. Hugh, here you go.
Okay, great. I appreciate your comments there, as well as some of the questions. I found them very intriguing, if you will. I just wanted to wrap up the session. You know, most of you today, and I'm just navigating this to show my screen. Hopefully you'll see my slide. Most of you today had come by the SMART Recovery booth at the TERC conference and potentially gathered some information about SMART. This is the fourth year that SMART Recovery has participated in that conference. And from my perspective, the very first year, the comment that I always got was, I don't know about SMART Recovery. Versus this year, many, many people said, yeah, we know about you. We really like you. But I wanted to make sure that you understood that, you know, SMART Recovery website has tons of information available for you. You know, this site was developed in 1998. Today we have more than 80,000 unique visitors per month to the site, and there's over 64,000 people that are registered participants, that are new people participating in it. On the site, there's more than 1,000 pages of downloadable materials. It lists all the meetings that are available in the United States, who you can contact to find out more about that particular meeting, as well as address information and times and things of that nature. On the site, there are online meetings, message boards, chat rooms, blogs, podcasts, which incidentally, today's session is being recorded and will be transitioned into a podcast and posted to our website. I know one of the other questions that was in the chat room is, can we have access to the slides that were made today? And certainly anyone that would like those will have them more than available to you. So when we announce that the podcast is available, we'll also offer, if you'd like, a copy of the slides for your usage. And secondly, you know, in your profession, we ask you to recommend SMART Recovery. We, again, going back 9 years, only had about 7 meetings in the capital region. The capital region is Maryland, Virginia, and DC. Today, we have more than 50 meetings. And part of the reason that the word has spread is that you in the profession have recommended to your clients that they try smart recovery. It's a different approach. I have found that about 30% of the people that attend the meetings go both to smart recovery and other meetings as well, some of the 12-step or other meetings in addition. We also ask that you become a volunteer to smart recovery. We are only a group of volunteers that support smart recovery. And the first way is that you're able to facilitate a meeting and perhaps even become an advisor. An advisor is a person in the profession that helps us facilitators, who 90% of us are not in the profession. We've just gone down that rocky road and we're trying to give back. But an advisor can help us with some difficult challenges that we have in the meetings that we're not normally experienced with. And going back to my initial introduction, is I went to my advisor on that first meeting when the individual said that he didn't want science to help him stop. I went to Dr. Raphael, our local advisor here in the Baltimore area, and asked him how to handle that. And it was extremely helpful to me. And then finally, smart recovery only survives by way of donations. The materials today that we put together, the mechanism, the go-to training session, are all paid for by the donations that you all can make to our organization. Finally, as an acknowledgement of your participation today, we're offering three different prizes that will take all the attendees and choose. The first will receive two autograph books by Dr. DiClemente, and the second is there'll be two winners that receive a free registration to our Smart Recovery Facilitator Distance Training Program. That program is about an 8-week online program that allows you to understand more about the Smart Recovery philosophy and enables you, if you want to actually facilitate a meeting, to become an official facilitator of Smart Recovery. So again, we thank you, Dr. DiClemente, for taking us through this excellent presentation. If anyone would like to contact me directly, please don't hesitate to either use my email address here or give me a call. I'll be happy to provide you with more information. Thanks a lot for spending the time with us today, and I hope you make today a great day.
Thank you so much, everybody. Truly a delight. Dr. DiClemente, I cannot thank you enough. Thank you.
You're very welcome.